You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thinkum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam, Nisiaya, Anthas Yakuya, Talit, Sin, Homasque, Mustail.
From CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, this is UBC Arts on Air. We're your hosts, Brittany Dugan
and Rachel Sanders. On each program, we feature the ideas and stories of students, faculty, and staff within the Faculty of Arts at the University of British Columbia.
This evening, we meet Professor of Psychology Jessica Tracy, Director of UBC's Emotion and Self Lab. Yes, we have one of those here on campus. She's the author of the new book, Take Pride, Why the Deadliest Sin Holds the Secret to Human Success.
She's actually a leading expert on the emotion known as pride, and she let us drop by her office last week to ask her about her book and her research into human emotions and the ways that we can use pride to become our best and brightest selves. Why did you decide to focus your research on pride?
Well, when I started grad school, I was really interested in emotions. It was kind of a hot topic at the time, but it was also just sort of the thing I was interested in because I've always been interested in kind of basic level mental processes. And that's really what emotions are. They exist at this very basic level of the brain and the mind, and they shape all other kinds of behavior that we do. So my feeling was before we can get into complicated relationships or decisions people make, I want to figure out sort of the basic mental mechanisms that drive all that. And my graduate advisor at UC Davis, where I was in grad school, was someone, Rick Robbins is his name, who studies the self and self-esteem and self-enhancement and why people want to feel good about themselves. And so he and I realized that there are a set of emotions that exist kind of at the intersection between work on emotion and work on the self. And those are the self-conscious emotions. And they're emotions that are all about how we feel about ourselves and how we feel when we evaluate ourselves. And they include shame and guilt, but also pride. So that's kind of how it started. And we did some research on shame and guilt, as well as pride. But we quickly realized that pride was this kind of vast open area because almost no research had been done on pride prior to when we started our work in the early 2000s. And so you kind of go where the work is good and exciting. And that's what we found. There was just a lot to be done.
And given what you know now about how important pride is, why had there been so little research done on it up until, was that about 10 years ago, you said?
Yeah. I mean, I think we started publishing on Pride in 2003, 2004. So yeah, that was kind of when it began. You know, there's a couple reasons for it. One is in the world of emotion, the emotion research, which really took off in the 80s and 90s and kind of started in the 60s and 70s. That work was very focused on emotions that were known to be biologically based and universal. And Paul Ekman did this foundational work where he found that there were six emotions that had universal facial expressions. People all over the world recognized and identified these emotions in the same way. And that was really important for the field of emotion because it said, hey, emotions aren't just cultural constructions. They're not something that differ vastly depending on where you live. They're something that are part of our nature, right? They're biological. And that kind of paved the way for a whole, you know, line of research on emotions. But the thing that it also did was emotions that didn't seem to be biological, didn't seem to be universal, were kind of left behind. And those got a lot less study. And pride was one of these. There was no evidence that pride had distinct facial expression. And our work suggests that's true. Pride doesn't have a distinct facial expression, but it does have a distinct expression that involves the face and the body. And we kind of followed Ekman's footsteps, basically, and tested this expression for universality. We traveled to Burkina Faso, West Africa, and tested whether tribal villagers living in kind of remote areas there, totally cut off from the Western world, whether they identified pride expressions in the same way that Americans did. And sure enough, they did. And so that's kind of nice evidence that, well, maybe pride is universal. You know, it seems to meet all the criteria that those other emotions that Ekman had found, you know, really meet in order to demonstrate this universality.
What is that expression of face and body? What does it look like?
Yeah, so the main component is sort of this postural expansion. So imagine pushing your chest out. I'm sitting here doing it now, even though we're on the radio. Shoulders pulled back, head tilted up a little bit. Smile a little bit. But it, like I said, you know, it's not just the face. If you just see the face of someone showing pride, you're not going to be able to know that they feel pride because it looks just like happiness. You need to see at least the head tilt and ideally also that chest expansion, that bodily expansiveness. And usually the arms are extended out from the body in one way or another, sometimes raised over the head with hands and fists, sometimes kind of akimbo with hands on hips. But the most important thing is that postural expansion.
Okay, you identified two kinds of pride in your book. Can you explain what those two kinds are and the difference between them?
Sure. Yeah. So this is another kind of really important finding that we had, which is that pride is not just one thing. And it's really confusing in English because we only have one word, the word pride, but we use it in really different ways. It's kind of striking how differently we use the same word. And other cultures actually have different words for these two things. So we've come up with distinct words to characterize these two kinds of pride that we found. The first we call authentic pride. And this is basically a pride in one's accomplishments. And it's the sense of confidence and self-worth that we feel when we've worked hard for an achievement and we know we've gotten there. And this is all about kind of helping us get to where we want to go to be the kind of person we want to be. The other kind of pride we call hubristic pride. And that's the pride that's really more about arrogance and egotism. And it's based not on actual accomplishments or realistic appraisal of one's achievements, but more on a grandiose and inflated sense of self, right? This is a pride that people feel when they want to make themselves feel better than maybe they actually are.
And so why do you think we refer to them with the same word, pride, when they're actually so different?
Yeah, well, you know, I'd say it's actually kind of a limitation of English, really. I mean, I don't know, you know, I'm not a linguist, so I don't know the origins of, I mean, I could tell you a little bit about the origins of the word pride, but I think it's just something that, you know, there is a similarity. It is all part of the same emotion that's about feeling good about ourselves. It's just that it's two different ways to feel good about ourselves. And one, I would say, is based on a realistic self-appraisal and the other is based on a more grandiose and inflated self-appraisal. But they are both about feeling good about ourselves and they're both about getting a status. Both kinds of pride seem to function to help people attain status, but two very different kinds of status.
You tell lots of stories about people in your book to illustrate the two different types of pride. How did you choose those individuals?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I was always looking for people who had an interesting story that kind of illustrated a point. That's kind of what you do when you write a book, right? So one example is I talked about Dean Karnazes in the very beginning of my book. Now, he's this very famous ultra marathoner, which means he runs races that are longer than 26 miles. Kind of a crazy thing to do, but there's a whole group of people who do it and are really dedicated to it, and he's one of them. But the reason he's interesting is because he didn't get into ultra marathoning until he was 30, which is quite late for an athlete, right? Most athletes start their careers fairly young. But he, prior to that, had been kind of a businessman. He had an MBA. He worked at a, you know, good job doing business, closing deals, and was quite successful. And woke up on his 30th birthday to realize that something was missing, that something was wrong with his life. It wasn't going the way that he wanted it to go. And he knew this, you know, I think milestones are a good time to kind of reflect and think about where you're going. And so turning 30 was that for him. And he didn't know what to do, but that night he went out with friends to celebrate his birthday. And got a little drunk, I think, and realized just this is not where he wanted to be. So he ended up escaping the bar he was in and just started running. And he ended up running 30 miles down the coast. He lived in San Francisco and he ran all the way down to Half Moon Bay, 30 miles away. And this is someone who hadn't run in 15 years. So, you know, the day after he couldn't walk. But he realized in that run that this was what he wanted to do with his life, that actually doing something physically punishing for who he wanted to be, that was what he needed to do. You know, and that's not going to be the case for everyone or even for most of us. He's a pretty unique guy. But what he knew was that even though he had a successful career, he was doing all the things that society wants us to do, right? He was supporting a family. He had a wife that, you know, he was very much in love with and really happy with, and everything was going well. He wasn't meeting the needs of his sense of self. And for him, that meant needing to make this major life change. But, you know, I think all of us, or at least many of us, experience this kind of awareness at some point in our lives where we're going along, things are fine, but something's missing. For whatever reason, we're not doing what we need to do to meet the goals for our identity, for the kind of person we want to be. And when we realize that, what we're experiencing is a lack of pride. And I think it's a good thing that we experience that, because what it does is it tells us we need to change our behavior in order to get those feelings.
So he's a good example of authentic pride that you were talking about. Another example you use is Donald Trump as an example of hubristic pride. Can you explain what it is about Donald Trump that makes him a good example of the other kind of pride?
Yeah, I feel like it almost goes without saying, but yes. And Trump just is amazing because he's someone who for years and years, I think throughout the entire time he's been in the public eye, he's exemplified hubristic pride. So I've been using him as an example for a long time, long before, you know, he got into politics, which is, I think, a really interesting thing because it, you know, it just shows pride does get you power. And I think that's part of how he's gotten power. But the way that he exemplifies hubristic pride is just his, you know, complete willingness to brag at every moment. I mean, he barely says a statement without saying something that's grandiose and inflated about himself. And it's very often pretty far from reality, or at least an exaggerated version of reality. And most people, I think, who feel this emotion at least are aware from time to time, or much of the time, about social norms that we all have in every society about when to express pride. And the norms typically say, don't express it all the time, don't express it in certain situations, or express it in ways that are socially appropriate. And Trump just ignores all that. You know, he just sort of, any chance he gets, he will brag, he will demonstrate his hubris. And so I think that's really interesting.
And it's not entirely unproductive, is it, that type of pride in a leadership role? It's not a 100% negative.
No, I mean, what we found in our research is that people who use dominance tactics do get ahead. So we've brought groups of undergrads into our lab and have them work together to complete a task, and we measure who's most influential. And we do that just by, we have everyone in the group after the task rate how influential everyone else was. We have outside observers watch videos that we make of them interacting together, and they make the same ratings. And then we look at how persuasive they were. So everyone in this task had their own opinions about how the task should go, and we can measure who was most persuasive, who convinced the most people to go along with their views. And what we find is that the people in the group who were seen as most dominant, which means that others who worked with them said things like, I was afraid of him, those people actually get a lot of power over the groups. They get just as much power as the people who are prestigious, the people who others in the group said things like, I respect him, I look up to him. So both dominance and prestige are actually effective ways of getting power and influence over others, which is why I think hubristic pride is adaptive at an evolutionary level.
But then what are the negative aspects of a dominant leader who has a lot of hubristic pride?
Well, although they get power, it's the kind of power that's based on fear rather than respect. And dominant leaders aren't liked. In fact, their followers typically dislike them. They don't like working for them. They don't like working with them. It's not an enjoyable process for them. And so what that means is, in addition to losing friends, right, dominants aren't going to have actual real friends. As soon as they lose the thing or no longer have control over the thing that's giving them their power, they won't have any influence at all, right? People are giving them power only because they feel they have no choice, which is why you see dictators often get taken down by groups, right? You have a group of people form a coalition together to take down a dominant leader. That's what often happens, because they don't want this person to lead. In contrast, a prestigious leader is given leadership by choice. So there won't be a coalition to take him or her down, because everyone actually supports their position of leadership.
So as you've been waiting for your book to be published, as you were researching it and then waiting for it to come out, what's it been like for you to see Donald Trump climb through the polls and, you know, achieve the Republican nomination? What was going through your mind when you were seeing that happen?
It was pretty amazing. It's sort of like seeing the things that you've written out actually come to life in many ways. I really do think that much of what he did, especially in the primary election, was about wielding tactics of dominance. So, for example, he would often literally intimidate people who would attack or criticize him. So other Republicans, activists, politicians who tried to say things about him on Twitter, he would respond just incredibly, you know, violently and say horrible things about them. He destroyed people's reputations on Twitter, so that actually people, there are a number of people, there's a New York Times article about this, who said, I stopped, you know, I deferred because I don't want to risk that. I have a reputation and I can't risk getting the kind of threats that I had. He had such a sort of angry mob of followers who would attack anyone who attacked him. It became really dangerous to do that. You know, he called his competitors names. You can see this, his debate tactics when he's debating with other Republican potential nominees. He literally would call them names and make fun of them. And that's a straight up dominant tactic, right? If I'm going to just attack you aggressively and manipulatively until I kind of get my way. And it paid off, you know, and I think the reason it paid off, you know, it's complicated when you have people voting for him. Obviously, he wasn't threatening voters and saying, you know, vote for me or I'll kill you. There was none of that. But I do think that people who voted for him saw him as someone who was going to be a force of aggression on their behalf. You know, I think these are people who feel, for whatever reason, that something's been taken from them unjustly, that the America that we live in now, or they live in now, isn't the America they should live in. And so they see him as someone who's going to take it back for them for whatever reason. And so they want someone who's going to be aggressive against others, against people who don't provide that. And I think that's what they see in him.
If we end up with a president, Donald Trump, south of the border, what has your research shown about what kind of leader he might be?
I don't even like to think about that. But, you know, I mean, I think as a dominant leader, it's hard to say, because typically dominance don't lead democracies, right? We see dominant leadership much more often in dictatorships. So it's hard to say what will happen in a case where he does depend on votes, right? I mean, we're still a democracy. The U.S. is still a democracy. So it's hard to say what will happen, but it seems pretty clear that he's not going to listen to others unless he wants to, right? He's sort of going to do what he thinks all the time, because that's what he's done. He doesn't put a lot of faith in advisors now, so it seems unlikely that that will change. And I think the other tricky thing with him is that it's hard to know what he cares about other than himself, right? And so I think it's really hard to predict even what kinds of policies he would put in place, what things he would care about, because so far all he's demonstrated is he cares about things that seem to get him ahead, and that's about it. So it's really hard to know, I think.
Let's pull back a little bit and talk about ourselves. What did you learn about your own relationship to pride through the research for this book?
You know, it's funny. I think writing this book forced me to sort of think about what the take-home message is, which isn't something that we as researchers often think about. But, you know, when you're writing a book, that's something people want. So I tried to do that. And the last chapter of my book, I think, attempts to do that. But, you know, once you start thinking about what the take-home message is, you do want to apply it to yourself. And one of the big take-home messages is about how to deal with success, right? So when we have a success, that's something that authentic pride motivates us to do, to strive for success. But when we have success, we're at this real turning point, because the pride we feel feels really good, right? But that's where the temptation to experience hubris really comes in strong, because you could think, okay, I had this success. I got here by wanting to achieve this goal. So to feel this feeling again, I just need to think of another goal and try to achieve it. And that's the adaptive thing to do. That's what we all should do. But it's often what we don't do, because the feelings of praise we get from others, the pride feelings we have in ourselves are really compelling. And so often we think, well, maybe instead of working hard again right away, maybe instead I can think of other ways to maximize these feelings right now. And so that's where people start to do things like brag, or maybe if I can post on social media about my successes, I'll get more attention for them, more praise. That'll continue to feel really good. And it can really kind of catapult into bad behaviors. You know, I think this is why Lance Armstrong ended up cheating, right? Is that he got so addicted to those feelings of pride he was having from all his successes. At some point, what became more important was the praise he was getting, sort of the awareness from others that he was the best cyclist in the world, that mattered more than actually being the best cyclist in the world. So he started cheating, you know, and that's what's ironic about cheating, right? Is that if you're becoming the best cyclist through cheating, you're not actually becoming the best cyclist. So the self that you've been working so hard to feel good about is no longer relevant, right? It's all about this artificial self. And so I do think that's kind of the risk with success. And that's a lesson I try to kind of bear in mind, I guess.
So there's a light and the dark side to pride. We've talked a lot about the dark side, but ultimately the tagline of your book, Why the Deadliest Sin Holds the Secret to Human Success. Can you just sum up what it is about pride that it seems, when I was reading the introduction, it's really at the heart of everything we do?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's at the heart of everything we do that it's about more than just surviving. I think that's the way I would put it, that we have basic emotions like anger, fear, sadness, and happiness to kind of get us by, right? Those are the things that motivate us to make sure we have food on the table, a shelter, and that, you know, friends that will take care of us, right? That's really what we need. But to become the species that we've become, where we do a lot more than just get by, right? We have these amazing achievements, whether it's scientific discoveries or technological innovations or artistic creations. To do that, which is all about going well beyond survival, we need to want to feel pride, right? We need to want to feel good about ourselves, because that's what motivates us to persevere and put the hard work in, even when it's not pleasurable, even when there are far more pleasurable options we could choose. We forego those and sacrifice those even, and even put ourselves through pain. I mean, think, you know, Lance Armstrong or Dean Karnazes, in order to get pride.
So how do you see pride play out on social media? Is that a place where we can get tripped up and display too much of it, or in the wrong way? What's your advice for social media?
Yeah, it's so complicated, you know, and I think it really varies by social group to social group, and even social media domain to social media domain. I'm probably using those words wrong, but, you know, I think, and I'm far from an expert of social media, so, you know, take my advice with like lots of grains of salt. But, you know, I do know on Facebook, we all see those people who talk about their achievements all the time. And my feeling about Facebook is it's like, you know, I'm going to talk about, you know, show photos of my daughter, or like talk about, you know, something fun that I just did or something like that. And I think most people see it that way. It's a way to connect with friends. So then where does talking about successes come in? And for some people, it's fine. And I'm going to give you a like, because that's a big success. And for other people, no, you know, it's too much. But at the same time, I think your friends want to know about your successes, you know? So it's really tough figuring out how to post that kind of stuff in a way that doesn't come off as hubristic. And maybe the best thing is moderation. Choose your success, choose which successes, don't post everything. How you say it, how you talk about it might be important. To express humility, appreciation of the others who are involved, I think that always really helps. But again, like, this kind of thing is the hardest thing with pride, is you want to benefit from it because it does get us status gains, right? Feeling pride and showing pride to others boosts our status, makes others respect us. But at the same time, it's really risky because we don't like people who come off as arrogant. And what determines, you know, what distinguishes authentic pride from hubristic pride, that is to say the perception of it, really varies from culture to culture and society to society. So you kind of have to know the cultural norms really well.
Where is your research going next?
Well, I've been doing a lot of work on pride, and in my lab, we do work on pride, but we do work on other emotions as well. So there's stuff that we're doing now on shame. We're doing stuff a lot on status now. So kind of taking it from pride to sort of figuring out what are the consequences of these different kinds of status? What happens when dominant leaders do get power? Is that bad for the group entirely? Or are there maybe some benefits to being led by a dominant? And what are the pros and cons? How do dominance and prestigious people retain their power? What kinds of nonverbal signals do they show? That's kind of one direction related to this, I think, that we're building on now.
Jessica Tracy, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That was Professor Jessica Tracy, director of UBC's Emotion and Self Lab in the Department of Psychology. Her new book is called Take Pride, Why the Deadliest Sin Holds the Secret to Human Success.
Interesting. I, for one, can spend too long thinking about whether I should post something or not, and I usually end up just aborting.
Yeah, there's tons to think about in that book in terms of what pride means and what it can do for you and how to use it, really, to be a better person. Brittany, did you know that the School of Music puts on a concert every week at lunchtime?
I didn't, though I should have. It's almost 50 years old. The series started in 1967 and has been running ever since, Wednesdays at noon.
My name's Lori Townsend. I'm the Concerts Communications Manager at the UBC School of Music, and we are at the Roy Barnett Recital Hall inside the music building, and it is a beautiful, intimate space within a very busy music school, lots of activity happening, but in the recital hall, the world is suspended.
Well, my name is Steve Caldestad, and this is the Steve Caldestad Quartet. That's sort of how we do things in jazz. Whoever gets the gig gets to just stick quartet at the end of the name. So we're going to start with a couple of tunes made famous, and a sort of feel and genre made famous by John Coltrane in the 60s. Just intense, just generally intense. If you listen to Coltrane's music in the 60s, it was just one word. Would be intense. So we're going to start that way, but then just in case we lose everybody and they all get sort of freaked out, oh, come back, don't leave, we'll lighten things up a little bit, and then end the set with a Cedar Walton tune. You know, we're just going to do our thing and cook, and hopefully word is out and people will sort of stroll in and check it out, because I'm not sure what we're competing with as far as lunchtime offerings today, but I mean, if I was on campus and this was happening, I would definitely come and check it out.
CITR Radio. Do you mind just answering a couple questions?
Sure. My name is Amanda Nah. I am in second year at the UBC School of Music. I'm studying opera performance. And what I like about these concerts is that it really brings the community here together in Vancouver. And you get to see all the local musicians and artists. It's just a great community event that happens weekly, which is really awesome, too. The range of musicians and the variety of different genres that come and play here, too, is really awesome. And it's a great opportunity for students to come and listen to amazing music and see professionals play, like, at university. Like, just, you know, part of the student experience.
My name is Abigail Ayala, and I'm a first-year student. I think it's very interesting because as a student, it's important to listen to other performers because that is a way we also learn what to do, what not to do, and how to, I don't know, like, how to act and on stage and that stuff. And I think it's always, like, enriching experience because there are musicians, like, from everywhere that come here, and they have always interesting things to share.
Today's jazz. Next week we have a new music group that's even going to have a visual artist. We also have early music groups that perform, so you can hear in the various keyboard things, piano, straight up classical, jazz piano like you'll have today. We have lots of variety happening every week. And these concerts are only $5. Somebody told me the other day they thought this was one of the best kept secrets on campus.
Thank you. Hi, Lori.
Hello, how are you?
So we're in for a treat today.
You are absolutely in for a treat today. I promise. You know they're here.
I know,
you're
I know.
Regulars.
That's right. Thanks.
Love that. What a treat.
Yeah, definitely stress relieving, a nice midday break. Highly recommended, and especially because it's one of UBC's best kept secrets and good value as well. $5 for an hour of music every Wednesday at noon.
You can find the full schedule for these Wednesday noon hours on the School of Music's website, music.ubc.ca.
You've been listening to UBC Arts on Air on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. We're your hosts, Rachel Sanders.
And Brittany Dugan. Join us in 2 weeks when we'll be talking Canadian media innovation with some of UBC's professors of journalism. That episode airs at 6:30 on Monday, October 31st.
If you'd like more information about the program, you can go to our website. That's artsonair.com. Send us an email if you've got something to say. That's artsonair.info@gmail.com. And you can follow us on Twitter @artsonair. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.